I don't think I can find the words to say how wonderful that was. That was great. And not only was the singing good, but my favorite part is the breath in the middle there. I'm always going to remember that. That was fantastic. Good job, Cleveland Crooners. You did wonderful. All that and ice cream, too. What a day. And I'm aware that I'm the only thing between you and ice cream at this point. Be a nice change from the matzo pizzas, won't it? No, no, okay. I've seen Tina's posted matzo's pizzas on Facebook, and they look wonderful. I haven't tried it yet. I'll have to tonight if I have any room left over. Well, this is maybe my favorite time of year. You know, the hard stuff's over. We've done the foot washing. We don't do any more embarrassing gross stuff for the rest of the year. That's it. I feel like after Passover, don't you feel like you've earned days of unleavened bread? There's so much that goes into it beforehand, and I know theologically that's dicey. We don't earn it, but you know what I mean. You put so much effort into it, and you know, if we feel that way, we didn't have to give our lives, and yet Jesus Christ did that and got to live again, and I imagine this was his favorite time of year, too, after the hard part was over. You know, about two-thirds of the way into his ministry, there was an event which is called the Transfiguration, but that doesn't quite say what it was, where he and Peter and James and John went up on a mountaintop, and God arranged a meeting, and Jesus Christ received what he needed at that point, and then they came back. But after that, before that is right when Jesus starts talking about the fact that he's going to die, and he doesn't mince words anymore, and he stresses it to the disciples. And at first they don't believe him, and Peter's immediate reaction is, we won't let anything happen to you, and Jesus got quite angry. But from that point on, his ministry was under a shadow, as it would be. I mean, there was still much more teaching to do and many more events to take place. But Jesus became the brooding lamb at that point. And it was a difficult time for him. And he needed support and he needed help. And, of course, he went through the sacrifice. And everyone he knew and loved left him, at least for temporarily. Some of them came back to be there for him. But he was all alone. And then came this time when he was brought back to life by maybe the greatest miracle that's ever taken place. And suddenly, it's a different Jesus. Suddenly, he's happy. Suddenly, he's mocking the 11 disciples that are left. Suddenly, he's making fun of them. Suddenly, he's fixing breakfast. Suddenly, he's telling them how to fish. It's an entirely different person. Sometimes, I think the thing I can't get over is how, and I hesitate to say this word, but it's all I can think of, how mischievous he is at that point. How, you know, he gives Thomas a run for his money, and how he reminds Peter that he didn't quite live up to everything that he said he was going to. And, of course, by the time he leaves, they were all on good terms, but it was a different son of man at that point. It was a happy time, and, of course, it's a wonderful time to be alive. There's no snow. There wasn't over there anyway, but, you know, we finally have reached the point where I think it's safe to think about putting your tomato plants out in another 8 weeks or so. You know, we've finally gotten to that time of the year. And it's as I said, one of my favorite times of year, not just because it's spring, but because it seems like that a burden is lifted when you understand God's way of life. Taxes are done, which doesn't hurt, you know, that's over with. And it's kind of a lighthearted time between now and the day of Pentecost. I like to read what happened, the events that happened between the crucifixion and the day of Pentecost. And that's not a great deal of work. There just really aren't that many written down. Mark doesn't include any in the original. Matthew has very few, and most of them are in Luke and John in the beginning of the book of Acts. But it's sunshine. It's happiness. It's 40 days that Jesus spent on earth at that point, and yet one of the main things that marks those 40 days is that Jesus isn't around very much. Have you ever wondered what on earth was he doing? Because he would show up and make fun of the disciples and fix breakfast or things like that, or tell them some very important things and give them some instructions, and then he'd be gone. And when I say he'd be gone, he wouldn't just walk out the door and say bye. He would just be gone. And people go, what? You know, what? He was messing with them at that point. He could appear in a locked room. He could disappear from a locked room. He could still have wounds and still have the body that he died in, and yet he could still eat. He could still go for walks with them. He could show up in different parts of the country at any time. I wonder if he didn't just become a tourist at that point. You know, he'd been rather busy the previous 3 years, and I think maybe he just slipped the surly bonds of Earth and just went to see a fjord or two, or a rainforest, or a koala bear, because he could. He could appear wherever he wanted to. God could do whatever was necessary to have Jesus Christ get around at that point. It was a happy time, and I think maybe, I like to think, you know, I can't prove it, that he thought, I've got 40 days, I'm going to be gone for a couple thousand years, there's things I want to see. Because even though we think Jerusalem's the center of the world, there's a whole lot more earth that we created, and I would kind of like to remind myself of the things we did. You know, we do the same thing. We like to take pride in our handiwork, and I wonder if he didn't do that. The point is, he was gone. He would show up, but he was gone. There's so much going on in our world that we don't even know about that God is doing, things that are possible. You know, at one point, someone asked Jesus a question, and it doesn't even matter what it is, but they came up with the wrong answer. It happened to be about marriage in the world tomorrow. How will it work? And Jesus' reply was, well, you're making mistakes because you don't understand the scriptures and you don't understand the power of God. Well, this is a group that knows the scriptures pretty well. As a matter of fact, I'm going to count on you to know scriptures very well because I'm going to make references to stories and things that take place in the Bible, but we won't always turn to all of them. I have a good precedent in that. That's the way Jesus taught, and it's the way Paul taught. They didn't quote chapter and verse, so I'm going to count on you knowing the verses. If you're unfamiliar with the Bible and just getting to know it, please talk to me or talk to somebody else afterward. We can point you in the right direction because, as the humorist Dave Barry often says after he writes something, I'm not making this stuff up that you're going to hear today. And if we fail you, there's always Uncle Google. You can always go to your computer and type in the words, and it'll pretty much refer you to the part of the Bible that we're talking about. Does anyone even use Strong's Concordance anymore now that Google's around? We do, but not in the same way that we used to. There's so much going on in our world that we don't even know about. For instance, you think right now that you're just sitting here on the verge of sleep, perhaps, waiting for ice cream. That's what you think. But what is really happening is that the chair you're sitting on is spinning around the world at approximately 1,000 miles per hour right now. We compensate for it, and thank you, God, that there is such a thing as gravity, because we don't worry about flying out of our chairs because they're going 1,000 miles an hour underneath us. We're moving with them, and so we don't notice. But not only is the surface of the earth moving, but the earth is moving around the sun at approximately 66,000 miles per hour. There is no road on earth that's zoned for that. And then the sun and the whole solar system is moving at around 43,000 miles per hour through this part of our galaxy. And the solar system is moving through the galaxy. This is all on top of each other at 483,000 miles per hour. And astronomers can figure out by the expansion of the universe that our galaxy is moving away from other galaxies at the speed of 1.3 million miles per hour. So never, ever, ever say you're just sitting there. You're moving at 1.3 million miles per hour, no matter what happens. And yet we just factor that out, and we make matzo pizzas. That's what we do. While we're moving 1.3 million miles per hour, we do things like tune pianos, or do our taxes, or chase deer away from our rose bushes, or things like that. We don't even think about all the things that are going on. So let's have some fun today. And I'm going to tell you to hang on, because we're going to move quite fast. We've got to get to ice cream. But let's have some unleavened levity. Reagan, I wore this today for you. This is for you, because I know you really like horses and matzos. Those are the two best things in the universe. Let's have some fun today. Let's show how great our God is and how puny we are, at least at the time being, and the reasons that we have to rejoice and be happy that there are forces moving in reality. I won't even say the universe, because the universe is only a small part of what's real. It's the part that we know of, the part that we can sense. So hold on, we're going to take a fast journey through some mind-challenging concepts. And I will tell you that almost all of this is speculation. The stories are out of the Bible. You can look up the things that I'm talking about. But these are things that I sit and think about as I'm traveling through the universe at 1.3 million miles per hour. Whether I'm in my recliner or tuning pianos, we have an awful lot of time to think. And so a lot of this will be speculation. And if you want to argue with me about the conclusions I come to, I would like nothing better after I get my ice cream, of course. From beginning to end, from the creation of the world to the appearing of New Jerusalem, there are miraculous forces at work. From the time the world was made, we don't understand how the world was made in 7 days. God leaves us clues about the history of the earth in the fossil record and in the light that comes to us from other parts of the universe, but it was made in unbelievably supernatural ways. When I say supernatural, all I mean is that it's beyond our understanding. Because we live in a universe that has four dimensions. And that might not even be accurate. Height, width, length, and time. Those are four dimensions. But strictly speaking, that might not be accurate. We know that there are many more dimensions than that simply through mathematics. That subject that we learned to hate in high school, but which in some ways is the language of God throughout the universe. It is truth, and it helps us know that there's more going on. We know that honeybees dance, and their dances are controlled by something in the fifth dimension that we can't understand. And we only know that because the patterns that they dance seem to show up in the higher mathematics. It's an incredible echo. We don't know how whales and birds find their home every year. We think we're homing in on it, but we really don't know. We don't know how a flower blooms in the springtime, even after such a hard winter. We know that there's things like day length and hormones and things like that, but we still don't know the trigger. We understand what they're made up out of, and we can do gene profiles and things, but we can't figure out exactly how that they work. The world was created miraculously, and the end of the Bible, which of course is not the end of time, the appearing of the New Jerusalem is another miracle. As a matter of fact, we don't even understand what it means, because it's a city that's as high as it is wide as it is deep. And actually, that's more than our minds can comprehend. We can comprehend north, south, east, and west when it comes to a city. But this sounds like it has more dimensions than we're used to thinking. And we'll have to become more like God to even understand that. And when you read the Bible from beginning to end, there's miracle after miracle. Miracles only being things that are within God's ability to do things. He knows the technology, but that we don't understand and that we can only marvel at. And there are people who say that all these things are just allegory and that they're not real and that it's just a way that humans make sense of the things that they don't understand. But do you understand what's built into that statement? What's built into that statement is that there's more going on than we can understand. That there's a need to understand more than we can understand. Already, we're on shaky territory here, but it seems to be an innate thing inside the human mind. And you know, you hear that in anthropology that humans have a need to worship a being. I'm not sure that that's true, but I do think that humans need to explain the unexplained. And often it comes out in the form of a higher being. In our case, we think of it as reality, and we think that it's literal. That's one thing that separates us from the part of the world that doesn't, is that we think that when God said that Moses parted the Red Sea, well, the waters parted and he walked in between. We accept that much, and we accept that we live in a world where there's things we can understand to the point where we can send a space probe past the planets and have it go exactly where we want it to, even though it's many hundreds of millions of miles away. And yet we don't understand how a baby can be born and come into the world and be alive. There's things that we can understand, there's things that we can't understand, but to God, they're just the available technology. I'm not saying that they're easy. As a matter of fact, I think some of the things are quite difficult and take quite a bit of coordination, and that's why he has to have so many gadgets that we call angels and so many beings that can help him out to do things, things that we can't see because our minds can only see four dimensions. And yet, there could be much, much more going on around us right now. As a matter of fact, there's good reason to think that, because if you recall, there was a story in the Old Testament in 2 Kings 8 where Elisha is in the middle of all kinds of things going on and they're surrounded by armies. Well, let's turn to that. Let's turn to 2 Kings and chapter 6. I think I said 8, but 2 Kings chapter 6. And this is something that was happening right around them. And because Elisha was tuned into God, he knew about it. Not necessarily that he could see it, but he knew that those things were there and that we don't have the senses to see them. And yet he asked that God would show his servant what these things are. And you know what I'm talking about. The Aramean army has come up against Israel, and it looks pretty bad. Things are going to get quite bad, and yet Elisha doesn't seem worried about things. And he says in verse 16, well, in verse 15, his servant comes to him. I believe this servant is named Gehazi. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. It couldn't get any worse than that. "Oh, my Lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. And the prophet stretched and yawned and said, "Don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Well, you know, that's what people say. What does that mean? Well, Elisha, in verse 17, prayed, "Oh, Lord, open his eyes so that he may see." There's other things going on here. He just can't see them. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire around Elisha. And other miracles took place because Elisha prayed to the Lord that the army would be stricken with blindness, and they were. But that's the part I want to touch on, that there's much more going on around you, and you just can't see it. And when that world interacts with our four-dimensional world and things open up and things cross across it, often there's fire and often there's light. Sometimes people's faces even glow. You know those stories. But here's a case where he sees what's coming from that other world or what is already there, and it happens to be horses and chariots of fire lit up by light, by high energy. So there is much more going around than we know, going on around us than we know. But let's look at some miracles just by examining the basic building blocks of what God can do. And these building blocks are actually very familiar to you. And 1,000 years ago, a person couldn't have stood up here and used these terms. But if I say these terms, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. We had our youth Bible study this morning, and we had a total of 2 Bibles and 2 tablets that people were looking at. They weren't books, and yet people had a Bible on them. And we were able to have a Bible study with only 2 books because people had those tablets. Well, computer terminology helps us to understand some of the things that God can do. We live in a world of limited dimensions, but other beings live in worlds with more dimensions. I want you to take a piece of paper, any piece of paper that you have nearby, whether it's your bulletin or something else, and I want you to just hold it in front of you and look at it and think of it as part of another world. Now, you're in a world with 4 dimensions. This is actually a world that only has 3. You could say 2 because it's height and width and depth, but time is in there too. And I want you to imagine that your piece of paper has no thickness, but all those little black dots on it might actually be living beings that can move around. This is just an analogy. It doesn't exist, of course. But the point is that here is a limited world, and you live in a world with more dimensions, and you can look down on that world. And you can take parts of that paper, and you can cut them up and move them around, except the beings who lived in that 2-dimensional world would not be able to see you. They would see you if you stuck a finger through that 1-dimensional plane, but they don't see you because you're outside that world. And yet you can make changes. You can erase things. You can rip things up. You can fix things. You can look above and see inside things. You can know what's going on. Well, that's a limited analogy, but there are beings who live in worlds with more dimensions than ours. And they can look at our world and they can see inside things. And they can move things and they can fix things and they can change the location of things. They can interfere in all kinds of ways. And some of God's basic tools, because of course that's the main being I'm talking about, in this are tools that you know well. One would be to cut. One would be to copy and paste. One would be to duplicate. You know what those terms mean, don't you? But for instance, let's have an example. There is a story in the Old Testament where there was poison in a batch of soup. And they cried out to the prophet Elisha and said, "What shall we do?" Well, what would you do? Wouldn't you make more soup? I mean, it seems like that's the way to go, only this time leave out the gourd that has the poison in it. I will assume that they didn't have too many ingredients. The story does say that it's mostly men. It might have taken a woman to come up with that answer. I will give them that. But anyway, they say to God, "Take the poison out of the soup." And for some reason, Elijah and God decide to humor them. So Elisha throws a handful of flour into the soup, and God is able, from his perspective, to select the poison. You know, I don't know what he clicked on, but he could select it, and he could delete it. And that was the end of that, and they ate the soup. Now, I hope he deleted the flour, too, because flour will change the consistency of soup. But they said it was good, and I will just take their word for it. Or maybe they altered the recipe after that. That's all I can think of. But the point is, God found the poison, he selected it, and he deleted it. Copy and paste is another thing God can do. You know the story of feeding the 4,000 and feeding the 5,000, where they have many people, but only a limited number of loaves of bread and fishes. My favorite version of this is in the book of John, and the reason is John, in chapter 6, there's two times that Jesus did this that are recorded. It seems like there might be even more, but both Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three of them record two incidences where it happened. So it's not just a case of the stories getting mixed up. It really did happen more than once. But John includes a detail that I just kind of like, and I think it says something about John, in that he's the only one who mentions the little boy. And so in chapter 6 of John, sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Well, whatever it takes. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with the disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming to him, he said to Philip, "Well, what shall we buy? Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" There was no giant eagle around the corner. Getting the groceries was a whole different proposition in those days. But he had something in mind. This was Jesus before he became the brooding Son of Man. And it says that he asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Jesus knew what was possible, and he knew what was going to go on. Philip answered him very seriously, "Well, 8 months' wages would not be enough to buy bread for each one of them to have a single bite." It wasn't that difficult a question, but Philip felt he had to embroider the answer. Another of the disciples, Andrew, Simon's brother, who was the first one we know of who had contact with Jesus and was maybe a simpler man, maybe a humbler man, but he just said, "Look, we've got a little boy here. And this boy's mother sent him with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. But how far will they go among so many?" And yet Andrew's the only one coming up with a beginning to the situation. So Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. I mean, it's people, of course, not just men. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as he wanted. He did the same with the fish, and when they had all had enough to eat, all 5,000, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. Many people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, and they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Isn't it interesting that it was just food? He just gave them something to eat. They didn't believe him when he talked about his father. But man, feed you, and we're interested. That's the way that it works. That's why we have refreshments at our seminars and things like that. It's part of what people respond to. But can you imagine Jesus' face when he was sitting there starting to break the bread and the loaves? Can you imagine? He's going, copy and paste, you know, more, copy, 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 paste, copy, 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 paste, 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 smile, smile, smile at the disciples. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, little boy. Very good. Copy, paste, paste. It took a long time to do the food that would feed 5,000 people, and it said that he did this more than once. I like the little boy because it adds quite a human touch to it, and I like to think that he was one of the first people who got to eat. It was his bread and fish, after all. And I can also see, you know, apparently he was there by himself when he was at home, his mother saying, oh, he did not. Because that's what mothers do. But this isn't the only time that that happened. Back in 2 Kings, it happened two more times. Similar things, the copy and paste. 2 Kings chapter 20. Oops, that's not what I wanted to go to at all. 1 Kings 17, please. 1 Kings 17, about the widow. And Elijah goes to the widow, and in verse 11, he says, please bring me a piece of bread. First he wants water, but then as she was going to call it, he says, and bring me, please, a piece of bread. And the widow says, as surely as the Lord your God lives, I don't have any bread. I only have a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. Now, Elijah was a fascinating man to me because Jesus' words about Elijah was that his ministry brought the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. And yet what we know about Elijah from his life story in the books of 1 and 2 Kings, he was a bit of a grumpy old guy. Well, I don't even know about the old part. But he wasn't an easy person to get along with. If you crossed him, sometimes fire came down out of heaven and wiped you and 49 of your friends out. That's not somebody with a lot of Facebook friends. But it's the way that Elijah was. And yet, maybe one of Elijah's main strengths that he had going for him was he knew what God could do, was that he could look at an impossible situation and know what God could do. And he was a very good friend of God's, and at this point, he knew what God could do. He knew what the powers were, and he knew that God would make it happen through him, that he wouldn't be the one doing it, but that it would happen. And so, in verse 13, the widow has just basically told him that they're going to eat their last food and then die because there was a famine in the land. Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said, but first make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me and then make something for yourself and your son. In other words, you have to trust God first. That's an interesting test. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, the jar of flour will not be used up and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land. It doesn't talk about the woman's attitude, but it does say that she went and did it. And doing it says a whole lot for the woman. Whether she truly believed it, she did it. And it happened. In verse 16, for the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. And Elijah wasn't even touching this, nor was God or Jesus Christ. It was just looking down and saying, copy, paste, copy, paste, copy, paste. We can make this person happy. He just multiplied it without an end. So he can move things. He can make an axe head float if he needs to. He can change the location of something. And you know what? He can do the same thing with people. I don't know if you remember about Elijah, but earlier in this, one of the reasons Elijah was considered such a pain in the neck by Israel was you could never find the guy. He'd be in one town. He'd be in Ashtabula at one point. And the soldiers would go to Ashtabula to find him, and suddenly people would say, he's in Lorraine. And then he'd go to Lorraine, and somebody would say, he's in Medina. And he didn't take much time to get there. He would just be gone from Lorraine and appear in Medina. And that's one of the things that really annoyed the king about Elijah and got him quite angry, is that God could just copy and paste Elijah. Things like that can be done. We know that that happened with the Apostle Philip in the New Testament. He was talking to the eunuch, and after he baptized him and explained scriptures to him, I don't know why in this particular case God did it, because it doesn't happen a lot in the New Testament, and I don't know of any case of it happening in our day. But at that point, Philip was needed elsewhere, and Philip was gone. The eunuch was looking at him, and he was gone. And Philip still had work to do. He still did other work, but God had moved him. We know that Elijah got moved by what? A chariot of fire. When things come out of the higher world into our world, there's almost always light or fire. It's the way that it is. God can also fiddle with time, because time, really, to God, is just one more dimension. Sometimes I think that the reason time exists is it's just something that happens when God lives. We really don't understand what time is. We know how long a sermon is supposed to be. We know when the ice cream is due. We know when our taxes are due. We make appointments. We know how to work with time. We know about rhythm in music. That's just time. We couldn't have music without time. But what is time? Well, that's harder. Can you go backwards in time? I don't think so. And yet God knew things that happened before they took place, and it wasn't that he made them take place that way afterwards. They happened on their own, and God knew about them beforehand. So maybe God, in his dimensions, which is much higher than time, can be above us, and that's the term we use for God, but just outside our world, and look at our situation, and can swim and bob and weave and come up in time wherever he wants. And he can make other things do that too, because it's just a dimension. And you think, well, what proof do you have for that? Well, I can illustrate in Joshua 10. Joshua 10, a story that you know well, and people say could not possibly happen. Supposedly NASA backed up this story, but it turns out that was a hoax. If you've ever read that on the internet, there was no extra day. There never was any evidence for that. It was one man who said that NASA had the evidence, and no one checked up on the evidence. And yet, what did happen in Joshua 10? They're fighting, starting in verse 12, they're fighting the Amorites. And on the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, O sun, stand still over Gibeon, O moon over the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still, the moon stopped, till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jashar. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. But what really happened that day? If the sun stayed in its place and the earth stayed in its place for a day, according to the laws that God made, the world would go through a terrible cataclysm. The rivers would rise up into the air. The atmosphere would change. There'd be terrible earthquakes. There'd be electrical interferences. There'd be all kinds of things going on. And that's one of the proofs that people use to say that this didn't happen. That if the sun stopped in the sky, it would disrupt our entire solar system, but particularly the earth. That gravity would change, and that rotation would change, and all kinds of things. Well, I'm not saying that that's totally impossible and that God couldn't do it, but it seems to me, if there's no record of this in any other part of the world, where the Chinese didn't get themselves an extra day, and the people in Africa didn't seem to have an extra day, it seemed to me that what happened was that this was playing with time somehow. And I can't even pretend to explain it, but it makes more sense to play with time than actually stopping the sun. Maybe God could cut and copy and paste everything that was going on in that immediate area. Maybe he could just do an outline like we do in Photoshop and do a fill and copy everything that happened and move it backwards through time, or have it going backwards through time enough that it would appear that the sun would stand still. The point is that the people there saw that effect. We don't know exactly how it happened. I think it's fun to think about, but I think it makes more sense to think of this as playing with time, that God took the entire situation and moved it through time somehow and made it work out. And of course, they didn't notice it, just like we don't notice traveling through the universe at what is it, 1.3 million miles per hour. These people had no concept that Joshua said the sun would stand still and I can use these words and I'm not taking God's name in vain. And by God, the sun stood still. That's exactly what happened when they looked at it. But how did it happen? Well, that's open to other things. And the reason that I think that it would be more likely to do it this way is found in the story of Hezekiah. Because as you know, that was the only day where the sun stood still for that long period of time. But there was another miracle along these lines. And in 2 Kings 20, verses 9 to 11, we read about a miracle that was worked in the days of Elijah. And it was specifically in the days of Hezekiah. And it was specifically for Hezekiah, as you will see. This miracle was to show Hezekiah that God was in power and that he was doing things in Hezekiah's life. 2 Kings 20, in those days Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. The prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz, went to him and said, "This is what the Lord says, put your house in order, because you are going to die, you will not recover." That had been decided. But we know that God is merciful and can change his mind. And Hezekiah, who had been a good friend of God previous to this, but had gotten sidetracked, turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord, "Remember those times, O Lord. Remember how I have walked before you faithfully and with wholehearted devotion and have done what is good in your eyes." And Hezekiah wept bitterly. His heart was broken. He meant it. And of course, God, from his standpoint, can see inside and knows that that's what's happening with Hezekiah. Before Isaiah had left the middle court, the word of the Lord came to him, "Go back and tell Hezekiah," because you've just told him that he was going to die. And Isaiah wasn't Jonah. He didn't go, "Oh, you know." He said, "Yep, I'll do it." And he went back. And this is what, "Tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people, this is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. I have heard your prayer and seen your tears. I will heal you. On the third day from now, you will go up to the temple of the Lord. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will deliver you, this city, from the hand of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city for my sake and for the sake of my servant David." Then Isaiah said, "Prepare a poultice of figs," and they did so and applied it to the boil, and he recovered. But Hezekiah had asked Isaiah for a sign. "What will be the sign that the Lord will heal me and that I will go up to the temple of the Lord on the third day from now?" I hope that I wouldn't need a sign as long as I got healed, you know, that I would believe at that point. And I think that's what we would all hope. But Hezekiah asked for a sign. Isaiah answered, verse 9, "This is the Lord's sign to you, that the Lord will do what he has promised. Shall the shadow go forward 10 steps or shall it go back 10 steps?" Now, we think this could be a sundial. It could be a shadow on the steps going up to the temple. We're not really sure exactly what this word means, but it involved the sun. And Hezekiah reasoned correctly. He says, "Well, it's a simple matter for the shadow to go forward 10 steps." Really? You could make time? Okay, fine. If you think that's simple. He says, "It's harder to have it go backwards. And since the man was dying, I'll let him have that reasoning." But he's tried to pick the harder one. He's not only asking God for a sign, but he's trying to make it hard for God. God loves that kind of thing. So then, in verse 11, "Then the prophet Isaiah called upon the Lord, and the Lord made the shadow go back the 10 steps that it had gone down on the stairway of Ahaz." And that's the sentence that we get. But what was going on there? Because for the shadow to move back 10 steps, it means that the sun had to move in the sky. And if the sun moved in the sky, there would be all kinds of cataclysm. And furthermore, people all over the world would know it. And they didn't. And we know that because in 2 Chronicles 32, there's an interesting side note. It doesn't even mention this particular miracle. Well, no, it doesn't mention it in detail, but it refers to it in 2 Chronicles and chapter 32. It's the same period in Hezekiah's life. And in chapter 24 of 2 Chronicles 32, it says, "In those days Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. He prayed to the Lord, who answered him and gave him a miraculous sign. But Hezekiah's heart was proud, and he didn't respond." Well, that's the end of the story. By the time you get to the period on verse 24, the miracle that we're talking about had already taken place. That God had either moved the sun or caused the shadow to move somehow. And what I think happened, had to have happened, was that this was playing with time. That God took that whole region somehow and moved it backwards through time so that the shadow moved backwards. And the reason I think so is in verse 31. In verse 31, the envoys were sent by rulers of Babylon to ask him about the miraculous sign that had occurred in the land. God had left to test him and know everything that was in his heart. Word got out, but the world didn't know about it. They came to ask about it. And the fact that it was a localized thing means to me that God didn't play with a sign, but that he played with time. And so he just took it back to a time when the sun was in a different place. Now, they're both very difficult things to do, and I don't understand how God can do them. I'm simply using my mind to come up with those technologies. But, you know, God's scale is pretty amazing. We know when he recreated the world, because that's what happened in Genesis 1. You can certainly turn there, but I bet you know the story enough to just think about it in detail. One of the puzzles of Genesis 1 is what happened on the fourth day, when suddenly we have the sun and the moon and the stars in very specific positions. And I'm not even discussing now whether it was lights to determine when the holy days were, or lights to, you know, to help sailors sail, or lights to count days or whatever. The fact is that day four was the day that the earth and the sun and the moon were in position with each other. And before that, it wasn't. What happened? Well, we know that after Satan's destruction of the earth, before this, the earth had already been created and was beautiful in its own way, and there was a war that went on and the earth was destroyed, that it spun to a place where there was total darkness. We know that the earth was in darkness, and if the earth was in orbit around the sun, it wouldn't have happened. You could have had clouds or ashes or things like that, but that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says that we don't see the sun and the moon. There was still light. There was still light for half of the period each day. And so what did happen that day? Well, the universe actually shows signs of having, the solar system shows signs of having operated like a clock for billions of years without interruption. And yet we say there was an interruption these many thousands of years ago. And I think probably that what happened was it wasn't the sun that changed, but it was the earth that changed at that point. Because up to that point, the earth was in a place where it had artificial lighting of some kind. It was real light, but you know what I mean. It wasn't the sun and the moon, and it wasn't spinning like clockwork the way that it is. And I think what God did was he moved, copied, pasted, whatever it took, the earth at that point. Because if you drag it through space, you know what happens when you drag a comet through space? The water goes off it. What keeps life on earth? What had already created a firmament between the water and the sky and things? And if God had just dragged the earth into position at that point, who knows what would have happened? But he had the staff and he had the technology at that point that somehow he could just reposition the earth. And all it says was there was an evening and there was a morning the fourth day. I can't wait till the world tomorrow when we can find out how all these things happen. I'm just, as we say in Montana, woofing it right now. I'm taking the available information I have and coming up with possible explanations, but I'd be quite happy to be wrong if I can go to a class taught by a God or Jesus Christ or other notable authorities who tell me how this really happened. I can't wait. I still think it's fun to think about. Now that we've had a taste of the kinds of things that God can do without limit, let's look at one incident. And this is an incident that I've already mentioned. It's an incident that is mentioned four times in the Bible. It's mentioned in Matthew 17, in Mark 9, in Luke 9, and then it's mentioned, and let's turn to this one, in 2 Peter in chapter 1, verses 16 to 18. And this is a very important scripture because Peter was an eyewitness at this event. Second Peter 1, 16 to 18. This is Peter writing, "We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ." In other words, these aren't things that humans just made up to explain the unknown. We were there, and we saw them, and you have to trust that. We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. When was their majesty? Jesus was a person telling them where to fish. He was a person, you know, leading them from town to town. He was a person who spoke and did some miracles. But majesty, what's he talking about? Verse 17, for he received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory saying, this is my son whom I love and with him I am well pleased. We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain. Remember those words, the sacred mountain. They're important. Also remember that it's Peter telling you this because he's not telling you everything that's in his heart. This was an incident that touched Peter personally and deeply in a way that it didn't touch other people. And there are reasons that Peter would never forget this, and they're not all good reasons. They turned out to be all good. The story, of course, is what I referred to before as the Transfiguration, when Jesus goes up on the mountain with Peter, James, and John. And there are interesting details in the story that I wonder if you've noticed. And I will tell you right now that my interpretation of this story is somewhat different from what you may have heard before. And it might even go against things that you've seen in writing from our church, and it might go against sermons that you've heard. I want to emphasize that at our youth Bible study this morning, we had a review, and we learned the Ten Commandments. And we learned the fruits of the Spirit, and we learned the holy days and their meaning. So I believe in all the important things that talk about the kingdom of God. Please trust me on that. I'm not standing up here being a heretic. I believe in the things that pertain to the kingdom of God the same way you do. And I keep the days of unleavened bread, and I keep the Sabbath, and I hope the Ten Commandments for the same reasons you do, and I have the same dreams of Jesus returning to the earth. It's very important. So allow me a little leeway on this one, please. Isn't that what the trickster people always say? Come on. But let's look at it. And the fact that it's mentioned in Matthew, in Mark, and in Luke is in itself interesting because there was a fourth gospel by a man named John who was there, and he doesn't mention it at all. He was there, but he lets the other three tell the story. And there's thoughts that the book of Mark was heavily influenced by Peter, that he had a lot of input into what got written there. And, of course, Matthew was one of the 12. But remember that the three people who went up on the mountain with Jesus didn't tell the story till much later. They were forbidden to, and they didn't. So this was something that got around later. And maybe John thought that the story had been told quite well at that point. Matter of fact, I wonder, for certain reasons, if he didn't give Luke his version of the story. There's things in Luke that are there that it seems like only an eyewitness would have known. And the other thing is that, you know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke often repeat the same story in the same way. And I encourage you to read the story in the three different accounts because it's different in all three accounts. And even Mark, which is usually the short version and the model for the other two, and Luke elaborates on it, and Matthew's always proving something with scriptures, you know, how he is. It's not that way, that they all add their own little interesting details to it, and you really have to read all four accounts, because I include the book of 2 Peter as one of the accounts, to get the whole picture. But let's turn to Matthew 17, and I will trust you, when I bring in other details, that you will be able to compare it with the other stories. Matthew 17, my chapter is entitled The Transfiguration. But before this, it's important to know that something had taken place, and it happens in all three gospel accounts. In verse 13 of 16, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi up north, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And of course, they come up with all kinds of ideas. Even Elijah, go figure, that person who we've talked about already, or Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. But Jesus needed help at this point. He needed validation. He needed support. And you remember the comic strip Zitz, about a 15-year-old kid? His father's an orthodontist, and he made the kid work at the reception desk one time when his reception was called out. And this elderly gentleman came in, and apparently he'd paid for an appointment for somebody at the orthodontist. And Jeremy says, may I help you? And the man says, he holds out his parking ticket and said, well, I need validation. And Jeremy leans over the counter and hugs him and says, you're a good man. Well, that's, Jesus didn't need his parking validated. He needed something else at this point, and it was why God made this whole thing take place. But Jesus is turning to his friends on earth, which included Judas at this point. And he says in verse 15, I know what they say, but what about you? I want to know who you say I am. And God bless Simon Peter. He turned to him and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus was happy because he blesses Peter at that point for saying that. Well, what does Peter do? By the time you get to verse 23, here's what Jesus is saying to Peter. Get behind me, Satan. You see a little change here? Peter's done the good thing, but then Peter misinterprets. So things are not going great for Jesus at this point. You know, he's the Son of God. He's in touch with God. He can hold up. But even the people who seem to understand don't understand. And yet Peter, yet John knows one thing. Jesus even calls him a stumbling block there. Boy, how many of you would like to go through history with it in writing that you were a stumbling block to Jesus? Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. He's teaching a lesson there, which doesn't really sink in, if you notice. But the important verse here, and again, this is in all three accounts too, is verse 28. I tell you the truth, some of you who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And Peter had alluded to that too, hadn't he? And so, in a nutshell, we have already a summation of what's going to happen. And I think it's important to know, because Jesus is saying this, that it had already been arranged. The place had been booked. The people had been notified. And somehow God had given Jesus the invitation that this event was going to take place. He already knew about it. In chapter 17, verse 1, the first three words in my Bible are after 6 days. In Mark, it says after 6 days. In Luke, it says after 8 days. I don't know why the discrepancy, but the point is there was some time that took place between chapter 16 and chapter 17. If this were strictly a vision, it could have happened at the nearest Starbucks. It could have happened in a bedroom. It could have happened by the Sea of Galilee. It could have happened anywhere. But there was a location that for some reason was important here. And I wonder if the location wasn't 6 days away. Or else what's the point of putting that in the Bible 3 times, that it was some distance away? After this takes place, of course, after the story, the three accounts differ the way they say it. Some of them say, well, when he got back to the crowd, when he got back, or when he got back to the disciples, but it's ambiguous. In Luke, it seems to say the next day, but if you look that up, that's ambiguous too. It just kind of says, when he got back. The only time frame we're given is at the beginning. Bear with me. Peter had referred to this as the sacred mountain. There is a school of thought that says that Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb was in Arabia. Paul refers to it that way. Even though traditionally it's on the Sinai Peninsula, that's the location that you would be given if you were to Google this. But there is reason to think, and that's a whole separate story and a whole separate sermon, that Mount Sinai really was on the western shores of what we call the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and that it was a reasonable trip from that part of the world. Remember that Peter had called it the sacred mountain. Let's read what happens here. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was changed or transfigured. I hate to use that only because it's a churchy word and we don't use it in any other situation. So let me use the word changed before them. His face shone like the sun. His clothes became white as the light. This happens when worlds collide with our world, as we've seen. But not only that, we know that this was described in advance as seeing the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now, God cannot be on our earth, but something was happening there. And Jesus says at the end of one of these accounts, he says, tell this vision to no man. And yet he's not really saying tell the vision. He's saying, tell what you've seen to no people. So we don't really know how to categorize this, except that there are people seeing Jesus transfigured. Verse 3, just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. So we know of 6 people. We know of Jesus, Peter, John, James, Moses, and Elijah. God the Father plays a role in this, but of course he can't be there. But we know that Jesus has changed, and they're seeing him in a way that they've never seen him before. Peter said to Jesus in verse 4, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Don't try to make that make sense. Peter didn't know what he was talking about, as it says in Mark. In Luke, it says he was scared and he was running at the mouth. When Peter defaulted to just regular behavior, he talked. I'm the same way, so I can't criticize. I don't know if you've noticed, but I just talk and talk. Well, Peter was that way. He didn't have to say anything that made sense. As long as Peter was talking, he felt secure. So he said, well, hey, let's build shelters here. Let's put up a structure for... It made no sense at all. And Jesus didn't even rebuke him. Instead, while he was still speaking, a bright cloud, enveloped them. And a voice from the cloud, somehow the voice of God the Father was coming through. They didn't see him, but he said, this is my son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. And of course, this is the greatest power in the universe telling Peter to shut up. And when Peter recounts it in 2 Peter, he's remembering that he's been rebuked in front of the whole world and that the world would know this history. It's something that Peter has to live with. Thankfully, he was a man of great humility and accomplishment and love. And as we'll see, Jesus Christ even did his best to patch things up after this. But Peter's memory of this time is that he was corrected, and not by the master, but by the father of Jesus at this point. Verse 6, when the disciples heard this, they lost it. They fell face down to the ground, terrified. The book of Luke says something else. Jesus came and touched them. He said, get up, don't be afraid. And when they looked around, they saw no one except Jesus. And apparently, he wasn't glowing anymore. They went down the mountain, and Jesus said, don't tell anyone what you've seen. Well, instead of just thinking about it, they start talking about it. Say, well, what's this about Elijah coming back, et cetera, et cetera? Because they've just met Elijah and Moses. Can you imagine? I have no idea what either of those men look like. When I picture Moses, I picture Charlton Heston. That's the only thing I know to do. So do you. So I don't feel so bad about that. But at this point, it was over, and Jesus, to put things straight, said, look, Elijah's coming. He will restore all things. Frankly, Elijah already came, and they killed him. They didn't recognize him, and they have done to him everything they wanted to. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. He was talking about death from that point on. And the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. But let's go back to the nuts and bolts technology of this situation and try to understand if we can figure out a little bit more about what happened. One question I would ask is, why was it Moses and why was it Elijah? Who was the friend of God in the Bible? Who's the one man who's called the friend of God? Abraham. Who's the one man who was called a man after God's heart in the Bible? David. Who's the one man who was so close to God that apparently they had a friendship long before Moses? And when it came time for the man to die, God arranged his death so that it was very strange and very unusual and unique for all time, because this man was a friend of his and walked with him. That was Enoch. Where are they? They're the good friends. They're the ones who knew Jesus well. And Moses and Elijah, of course, were good friends. But what did Moses and Elijah have that was related to this situation? Moses and Elijah both, in detail, we know, spent much time on a certain mountain. They spent time with God on a mountain. Elijah saw fire. He saw storms, he saw all kinds of things, and then he heard a still small voice, and that's how God talked to him. Moses had an experience with God on the mountain where his face glowed, where he encountered some other kind of world, and whenever he spoke to God, his face glowed when he went down to the, and it didn't die away really quick. He had to wear a veil over his face so people would just not be afraid to talk to him. Moses had some experience on that mountain. And why is it important to have Moses and Elijah there at all? The one thing we know that they're doing, they're not just standing there holding tablets or whatever Elijah did. They're talking with Jesus. There was a reason that God set this up so they would talk to Jesus. He was going into one of the most difficult times any human being has ever gone into. It's hard to imagine what was on his mind from that time on. And God was giving him support at this time. He took two good friends of his, and somehow the Father God conveyed to them that they were going to be used in a very special way, and that they would all be on the mountain in the same place But God would fiddle the knobs, and with his own technology, he would look around and do a conference call. And remember, when Jesus showed up there, Moses and Elijah were already there. Moses had never heard of Elijah. Elijah had heard of Moses, but they'd never met before. So maybe they had a few minutes to chat before Jesus and the guys showed up. Who knows? But at any rate, there was a special location. The location was important. So it's more than a vision here. God's doing a conference call, and I say that Moses was alive in his time and that God had told him that the Lord would suffer and would die and that this was the plan of God and that Moses would have the chance to bolster him up and strengthen his spirit. And I also believe that he did the same thing with Elijah, who spent time on that mountain. Jesus picked a very special place to do it. There was something going on between the worlds. There were forces changing. And one of the reasons we know this is that when you get to the book of Luke, it says that Peter, James, and John suddenly couldn't control it. They had an urge to fall asleep. And then they came too. But something was happening. And of course, we've always blamed Peter and James and John. We've always said they could sleep through anything. You take them to the garden and say, I need your help, and they fall asleep. You know, I won't name names, but there's probably people here who are asleep. It just happens. I do it all the time. You know, I nod off. And I always say when somebody says, well, you were nodding off, I said, well, ask me. I can still do the five main points. You know, thankfully, no one's ever taken me up on that, but whatever. But something happened. And remember when Daniel, who was a friend of God, met with God, Daniel fell asleep. Remember when Abraham had a vision that was a vision, but it took place among real sacrificed bodies that Abraham had made, had cut in two. This was on earth. That Abraham fell into a deep sleep. Somehow when the worlds change and come together, that's one of the things that happens to people because we're not built for that. And yet, they did wake up. It was before this part about the disciples falling on the face ground terrified. Read the section in Luke that says that. Somehow in all this, the disciples went through something like a coma and came out of it again. And how do we know that this was for Jesus and to strengthen Jesus? Because he said, don't tell anybody. He had witnesses, and God knows the reason for that, probably so that the story could be told and that so it could be told in different ways. But this was between Jesus and God. God had arranged this so that Jesus would have the strength to go through the rest of the terrible things that were going to happen. John says, towards the end of his gospel, when Jesus comes back in happier times, that many things happened, even just during those 40 days. I know he ends his gospel by saying there were so many things that Jesus did that I can't even write them down. And thankfully, three other people had written them down. But he says something else in chapter 20 of John and verse 30, talking specifically about the 40 days after the resurrection. He says, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written. John had a reason for writing it. He knew what his purpose and mission was. These are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. In the end, I find chapter 21 very touching because, of course, another funny incident takes place here. The men are fishing. Peter's gotten tired. They were supposed to stay in the town, but they left instead. Peter said in verse 3, I'm going out to fish. He didn't know what to do. And his friend said, we'll go with you. So they went in the boat, and they caught nothing, but it didn't matter. That wasn't why they went out. They didn't go out to catch fish and make money. They went out to get away. And they were fishing, and a wise guy on the shore yells out, hey, did you catch anything? And they said, no. And he said, well, hey, all you have to do is throw your net on the other side of the boat. I'll bet you'll catch a lot. And they're going, who is this person? What is going on? And the person on the shore is starting to go, you know, and Peter suddenly gets it. John stands up and he says, it's the Lord, but Peter's the one who jumps in the water. This was funny, you know. This was Peter giving them grief. They'd been through a lot. They'd run away. They'd earned all the little mocking that Jesus did of them. And yet, he turns this into a wonderful experience. First of all, he feeds them breakfast. They did cast their nets to the other side, and they pulled up so many fish that it was hard to tow them to shore. It took them a while to do it. And Peter wasn't helping. He'd already jumped in the water and swum ashore. One of the miracles was that the net wasn't torn. So this was a prearranged thing. Who knows how Jesus did it? As we know, he had his methods. They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. Boy, this was an echo of things they'd seen before, wasn't it? This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. But then there's a very comforting scene. When they had finished eating, Jesus went for a walk with Simon Peter. Doesn't say that, but we know they did, because they were walking down the beach, it says later. And he says, Simon, and he knew what was in Peter's heart, that Peter loved Jesus greatly, but he knew that Peter was feeling terrible about things that had happened, because that time on the mountain wasn't the only time he betrayed Jesus. As a matter of fact, you talk about Peter betraying Jesus, it's another incident entirely, isn't it? And Peter's all too aware of that. Simon, son of John, do you actually love me more than these people? And he said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said, well, feed my lambs. And Jesus said, but Simon, really, really, after all we've been through, do you really love me? Peter said, yes, you know I love you. And he said, well, take care of my sheep, the ones who are a little older in the service. And the third time he said to him, Simon, you really have to decide whether you love me or not. And Jesus knew what he meant. Peter was hurt, of course, because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. He said, I'm telling you the truth. I'm going to tell you something about your future. I know you love me, and I know you're going to serve me. And I want to give you strength right now the way you and James and John were with me when I needed it. He said, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you don't want to go. Well, Jesus said this to indicate the death. Peter didn't know that at the time, but Jesus said, follow me. And Jesus could tell just by being in his presence that things were okay. Peter turned and said that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them, John, his cousin and friend. This is the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, Lord, who is going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, what about him? Because there was a little friendly competition there. They were friends, but Peter said, well, how about that guy? And Jesus said, well, that's kind of up to me, isn't it? I can do what I want in that case. He's still chiding him a little bit, but he's being good about it. If I want him to remain alive until I return, well, what is that to you? You take care of Peter and you follow me. And so a rumor got started that John would live forever, and it wasn't true. John does his best to negate that. The trouble is John outlived all of them, so the rumor kept going. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. This was a happy time for Jesus and the disciples. It's a happy time for us. I highly recommend reading the things that happened after Jesus' resurrection because, as I said, it's sunlight and happiness and very uplifting and inspiring. But let's end by turning to Luke 24 and the very end. This is Jesus about to fly away. And we say, well, Jesus didn't fly away. And yeah, he actually did. He went up in the heavens. I have no idea how this worked out. I have no idea what the logistics were. But somehow God and angels moved him through air because human beings can't do that. And, you know, we don't know all the circumstances at this point. But God used his miraculous powers to lift Jesus Christ up in the air. And he looked like a man as he was leaving. And they're standing, just staring. And he's gone so far that they can't see him anymore. And maybe at that point, that's when the bridge between the worlds opened up and Jesus, from that point on, was at the right hand of God the Father. Maybe God did it during daylight in space so that the world wouldn't see a thing, so that the light that was generated at that point wouldn't even show up. There were clouds, we know that. But whatever the reason, in verse 52, it showed that they understood and that they were happy about this. In verse 52, then they worshiped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. They still had a lot to think about, but these were happy times. And they stayed continually at the temple, praising God. And that's where we shall leave them.